Would you please join me in welcoming again Andrew Pudawa to the podium?
Thank you. So, this talk began as a form of therapy for myself, because I was feeling, and have continued to feel, some angst about living right now. And this angst has to do with the problem that I feel my whole world could possibly change very radically, perhaps very suddenly, and probably not for the better, at any moment. And yet, I have to continue living my life, being a husband, being a father, a grandfather, running a business, as though life is going to continue on just as it has been going. And so there's a cognitive dissonance that has stressed me. Does anyone else feel this stress to some degree? So I feel like mentally I have to somehow prepare for a possibly very uncomfortable and challenging future, while at the same time just being prepared as if nothing will change. And I don't know what to do. I've been stewing on this, and this angst drove me to write this talk as a form of therapy. So you will be either the beneficiaries or the victims. The outline, as you have noticed, is the title: Conquering Corrupt Culture, Raising Christian Communicators. So we're going to spend a few minutes on each of these words and look at some of the implications of these words in how we do stuff. The first word, conquering, to me is very, very useful because it has implications. The first implication is that I am in a war. Not just a battle, but an extended campaign. And in a war, you allocate your resources differently than when you're not in a war. This is true for nations. I think it's true for individuals. And so it helps me prioritize to remember that I'm in a war. And the war is not an easy or simple war. It's a very complex one because it's happening on three fronts simultaneously. The first front is the attack against me personally. The second front is the attack against my family and the little world that I know. The third attack is the attack against my bigger world, my culture, my country, my life. Right? And I have to think about this. So I came to realize some years ago in a very shocking but fortunate way, that there is an evil force that would like to take me out. And this war against me personally, the attack of the evil one on me personally, is where I need to be most vigilant, most diligent, most careful. Years ago, I had an acquaintance. I was working on a project with him. I was in Chicago, and I went to his home for dinner. And it was just one of the most horrible evenings that I can remember in my life. And I'll tell you why. This man is the head of a very large, the largest homeschool organization on the planet. He was the head of this whole thing. This is a massive group of people. I was doing some work for them. And he kind of like walked on water in my mind. He was not much older than I was, but this like super together successful guy. And he invited me to his home for dinner, and he had 9 children. And so when I came in, the place was immaculate. And I sat down at this very large dining table, which had a white tablecloth and folded cloth napkins and a few too many utensils and china. And I'm thinking, oh man, I don't even know what to do with these little forky things. And then he sat down. And the first kind of disturbing thing that happened was he discovered under his plate, at his place at the table, a circular piece of paper upon which was written in a circular spiral fashion a note from his 10-year-old son that basically said, "Dearest Father, you are such a great example to me. You show me Christ every day and how you love and care for us all." And I just thought, none of my children have ever said anything like that to me, especially at 10 years old. So then the service began. The food started arriving. His wife sat down. All the children served the food and passed it around so nicely. And they were just so quiet. And we had this nice conversation. And I'm just not liking this too much. And then, when we were finished, without being told, the children cleared all the table. One of his children, probably a boy of 7 or 8, came over with a little mini dustpan and a little mini broom to dust the crumbs off the tablecloth. Then dessert came, and while we were eating dessert, 5 of the children began to perform string quintets from memory. And I left that evening thinking, I am a total failure. If my family was 1/100th as good as his family, I could feel successful, but they're not. We are a disorganized mess. About 1.5 years after that event, I received a phone call. I remember exactly where I was standing when I answered this phone, and it impacted me more powerfully, perhaps, than any other bit of information I had ever received. This man had been having an ongoing affair with a secretary 14 years younger than him that involved all sorts of things I will not mention, but resulted in him leaving the organization, leaving his wife and children, and moving to Las Vegas with her. And I just remember thinking, that's just unbelievable. If that guy could get taken out, anybody, who am I to think I'm impervious to temptation and attack? I mean, maybe it wouldn't come in that exact same form, but I have got to be careful. Because the more good you can do, the more Satan hates you. The more he wants to take you out so you cannot do good. And I will tell you, that organization went on a decline and never recovered. And it is a small shadow today of what it once was. And the good that could have been done for many was lost. So I realized from that moment, if I'm going to operate in this world of trying to do good, I must be vigilant to put on the armor, take up the shield, wear the helmet, cover myself with the blood of Christ, be in that grace, or what could happen? I cannot assume that I am above temptation. And that, of course, is the battle that I am least wanting on a daily basis to fight. It is the one I am most happy to kind of ignore. But his failure, his disaster, became a lesson for my whole life. And this happened about 16 years ago. The war against my family is the one that would just bother me all the time. I had this image. Here's my house, here's my family. My family's in my house. And outside the house is this very toxic chartreuse, because that's the ugliest color. Very toxic chartreuse gas that's trying to get into my house through the cracks and breaches and poison my family. And I was running around trying to put wet towels under the doors and put duct tape on the windows and try to do everything I could to protect my children and my family from the poison of the external. And I couldn't do it. I even tried to move to the middle of nowhere to escape the pollution, but I couldn't because it's just everywhere. And then one day, someone suggested an idea, and I thought, yes, positive air pressure, right? You can't keep it from creeping in unless you have positive air pressure pushing it out. And what is that? What is the invisible force that creates the positive pressure? And that would be prayer. More diligence in prayer. I am fortunate to be married to an unbelievably prayerful woman. She is so much better at praying than I am that if I didn't have her, I would be a total mess, honestly. But she has prayed us through so much. And yes, the poison has got in, and there's been things with kids, and it's been challenging, but this prayer pressure has always been there. And we're still kicking. We're not killed yet. Now, the third front, which I fight in this war, is, of course, the battle against my world that I love. It's the battle against my culture, and I see it eroding in so many ways. And it hurts to see bad things replace good things. And whether it's, you know, politics or media or whatever, it hurts. Every presidential election hurts more than the last one. Right? And I keep thinking, how bad can it get? But what I have to realize is this front is actually the one where I can do the least. I can't do much to change things. Right? I can't change the books and the movies and the horrible music and the awful politics. I can do my little part here and there, but I don't have power to change it. And I have to be very careful because it's easy for me to get distracted and rail against the beast. Right? But I can't slay that beast myself. I can participate, but I can't get distracted from these other fronts. And I reached a point at which I realized I was exhausted. I was just tired. I didn't want to fight anymore. I just wanted to be over. Have you ever hit that point in life? And you're just like, I'm just too tired. And then I realized why. I realized it was because I was operating in this whole thing like always on the defensive, right? I'm always on the defensive. It's always the big force against me, and I feel like I'm losing. And you know, it's hard to get your energy up. It's hard to keep going when you feel like you're losing. You know, in a sports game, right? If you're losing, if you're on the defensive. But if you're winning, if you're attacking, it's easier to keep your energy. And so I thought, that's that. I am going to go on the offensive. But I will tell you, there is a problem with that. When you go on the offensive, you run the risk of becoming offensive. And I have a fundamental flaw that is the result of the fundamental sin of pride, and that is I really want everyone to like me. I do not like it at all when people don't like me. I hurt. And I just realized I can't do that. I can't just hedge everything. I've got to be willing to say what's true, and if they don't like it, that's their problem. I can't let myself get hurt. And this was a slow transformation because I'm still very attached to everyone liking me. But I got it. I got it. So when I realize that I'm in a war, you know, I grew up, I told you, not Christian, but we got hauled into the Lutheran church every now and then. I didn't know what was going on, but I will tell you there was one thing. If it happened, it made the whole trip to church worthwhile. And if it didn't happen, I was always very disappointed. It was a song. It was a particular song that would be sung occasionally. You rarely hear it in churches anymore. It's offensive. Onward, Christian soldiers, marching as to war! Oh, that song gives meaning to a 10-year-old boy in a Lutheran church service. I don't know what we're doing, but that sounds good. There's a particular construct you may be familiar with if you are perhaps raised Catholic or associated with Catholics at all. It's a construct of the divisions of the universal church. So there's number one is the church victorious, the church, what's the word? Triumphant. The church triumphant. Those are the saints in heaven, right, who operate there with God to channel graces to the rest of the church. Then there's the church suffering, which are those souls who died in friendship with God but need purification before they attain that, and they can pray for us, and we can pray for them, and the saints can pray for everybody. You can take that or not, the church, the purgatory idea. What I want us to buy into is the third division of the church, which is us. Do you know what it's called? The church militant. Why? Because we are fighting a war. And if we remember this, we prioritize. We prioritize our time for prayer and other important things. We prioritize our resources. We prioritize our relationships. It helps make choices. The next word is corrupt. We are fighting against corruption. Now, you can rail against corruption. You can find it anywhere. It's all over institutions, governments, businesses, schools, churches. It's corruption in us, right? But if you want to get any progress, you kind of need to look at the source of it, right? And you could say, well, it's obviously sin. But there's another way in which corruption has gained a greater foothold in our modern world, and that is the non-gospel of relativism, the anti-gospel of relativism. And this is one reason why I think Christians need to be very, very careful about putting children in public schools today. And I will tell you straight off, some of the best people I know are public school teachers, and they work so hard and live a life of sacrifice. But the problem, and they know it, the whole system is based on a flawed thinking. You know, some people say stupid things, particularly around election time, but one of the stupid things people say is, well, we have a separation of church and state, right, in this country. No, we actually have a state church. We have a required belief system. It is the non-gospel of relativism, and its temples are the public institutions. See, if in most schools, there are exceptions, but in most schools, there's no exception in California, but in most schools, everything that happens is predicated upon one basic thing, right? Every interaction with every teacher, every conversation with other children, every textbook that is in the public institution, it's all predicated on one idea. You can have your truth, she can have her truth, he can have his truth, and I can have my truth. We can all be free to believe whatever we want to believe, as long as we all believe that everyone's belief is true. But that violates the very first principle of logic, of non-contradiction. You cannot have two things be opposites and true at the same time. But we can't offend anyone by claiming that one truth is better than some other truth. Now, what are the implications of this? Well, the problem happens when kids grow up, right? And they have to start making decisions on their own. You may have come across this years ago. There was a book called Already Gone. I reference it in the bibliography there. And it was a meta study. It was a study of studies to say, what have we found out about what happens to Christian kids when they leave home? And the outcomes are not good. In fact, depending on the study, somewhere around 60 to 80% of Christian kids stop attending church, stop participating, stop practicing their faith, however you want to phrase it, within 1 year of leaving home. How does this happen? You raise them up, and then they abandon their faith. Well, you see, you can't overcome the programming. 14,400 hours you spend in public schools, and the subtle message continuously broadcast is you can believe whatever you want to believe. So they leave home, and someone says, hey, come here and do this with us. And the kid first says, no, I can't do that, I'm a Christian. But on the other hand, I don't have to believe what my parents believe. I could believe whatever I want to believe. I could actually redefine the truth in a way that would let me go and do whatever I want. And that's what happens. And so this relativism creeps in, where everything is just relative and a matter of opinion. And it happens in the area of culture in a big way. But the news for kids who are homeschooled is a bit better. The statistics for homeschooled Christian kids are that 1 year after they leave home, around 80% of them are still attending church, practicing their faith, being active, even doing evangelical work. Why? It's because those 14,400 hours were yours. If you're going to go up against 14,000 hours of programming with Awanas and 2 hours of church on Sunday, the odds are just against you. You just don't have the volume of experience to counteract the program. But when you keep those kids in an environment where truth, with the capital T, is believed 100%, you don't redefine that. And we see the most absurd representations of the redefining of reality now, don't we? You just wonder, how far can this possibly go? Culture, though, is really where it all comes from. Now, culture is such a fascinating word. It has three analogous definitions. The definition that comes to mind first is the stuff of life, right? The culture. The movies, the books, the music, the art, the architecture, the food, the fashions, the stuff of life, right? That's how we think of the word culture, kind of at first. But there are two other definitions, the third of which illuminates our understanding. The second definition is the corporate culture, i.e. the way we do stuff around here, right? And your family, you have a corporate culture, right? Businesses develop a corporate culture, right? And that can be represented in various ways. Some families are more scheduled and organized and have rituals and things, and other families do those things differently or less organized or less scheduled, right? I'm not saying anything's particularly good or bad, but what I would point out is that you have control over that. You do not have control very much over the large culture, but you do have control over what happens in your home. You can control what art is on the wall and what music comes through speakers and what movies and images come through screens and what people do and how they interact. You can influence and affect this. But it's the third definition that really illuminates. And that is the Petri dish. Culture, right? Remember high school science? You had that little yellow dish of Jell-O, right? That little yellow Jell-O dish. And that was called a culture. And what did you do with that culture? You put something in it, right? And then, if the culture was good, the thing you put in would grow. And if the culture was toxic or antiseptic, the thing you put in would not grow. So the purpose of culture is to grow something. Of course, like, duh, cultivate, grow. But see, the thing that we have to realize is that all of the cultures are supposed to grow something. Are they appropriate to what they're trying to grow? Now, a very interesting shift happened in the history of the world. It may or may not have been a byproduct of the Reformation, but there was a very significant shift, and it took maybe 100 years or so to fully happen, but it inverted the proper order of everything. Because once upon a time, this was the order. Faith had authority over education. Education then produced people. Those people created culture, which would grow, nourish, cultivate faith. That was the whole purpose of everything, right? Faith controlled education, right? But, and you know, at one point, even in our own history, it was very obvious. For example, think about Princeton, Harvard, and Yale, the most influential educational institutions. What were they originally when they were founded? Seminaries, schools of divinity. They were schools designed, purposed at educating Christian leaders for a Christian people. Now, what are they? They're just not Christian. They're anti-Christian. How did this happen? Well, it happened because somewhere there was a break, and education became its own god. Education came out from under the authority of faith and in a way actually displaced it, making itself its own authority. So education now exists, and it produces people who have no purpose other than to exist or to imitate the institution, which is to be their own authority. People come out, and then they produce art and movies and music and fashion and architecture, which is disordered because it has no purpose. See, 300 years ago, there was no market for bad music. Nobody wanted it. There was no music for bad books. No market for bad books. Nobody wanted them. There were no movies at all, right? And the plays were, what were they? Mostly derived from the Christian tradition, right? Shakespeare. People built buildings to be beautiful, to inspire. Now people do art just to be different. In fact, if you want to perceive some of the greatest ugliness you will find, go to the fine arts department of any public university. You don't get A's by trying to do something beautiful. That's blah. You get A's by being weird. And what's it all about? It's just about all self-serving. It's just all self-serving. So, this idea of culture, we want to say, well, okay, We can't control what everybody else does, but we can filter it, and we can create in our home a culture that truly nurtures, truly cultivates what we want. Now, you get to define that. What do you want to cultivate in your home? I'm guessing things like faith, love, selflessness, joy. So you've got to create the culture that does that. Now, Christian, no, I'm not there yet. Raising, conquering corrupt culture. By raising, Christian Communicators. Now, you probably thought when you heard that title, if you thought anything, he's going to talk about raising children. But no, I'm shifting. I'm using equivocation on you. We're in a war. We're in an extended campaign. And we're conquering because we know who wins in the end. We just have to get there, right? Or die trying. What do you need when you are in a war? Soldiers, you need forces. We need to raise armies. Now, this, unfortunately, means that we have to not be quite so complacent. See, I'm saying we as homeschoolers, but alternative Christian education and even Christian people working in public schools, we are coming to a point where we are very noticed by the bad guys, right? See, when you're a very small percent of the population, right? When homeschoolers are 2% of the population, nobody cares. You don't have any significant impact. But when you hit about 5% of the population, you come on the screen, and there are people who do not like what you do. In fact, there is a guy, Robert Reich, not the previous secretary of whatever. He's a sociology guy at Stanford University, and he kind of started this conversation some time ago, and it's bounced back and forth between Stanford and Harvard and other institutions, and it's gradually filtering into the media. And his basic argument, very simple, it's a simple syllogism, but see if you can find the fallacy. He believes this: Christian homeschoolers are the most likely of people to teach their children intolerance. Premise one. Premise two: intolerance is an enemy, if not the greatest enemy, of freedom. Therefore, Christian homeschoolers are an enemy of freedom. If you're not trained, it's hard to find the fallacy. Now, you can simply not like it, but if that's what he's writing in very big fancy academic terminology, and other fancy academics of his ilk are rereading and restating this, and then it filters through the press, if you don't think that freedom of education in this country could be ended almost instantly, then you haven't studied much history. And if you don't think Christians could be persecuted in this world today, then you definitely are lacking in history. And yet many of us run around kind of not thinking about this. We are in a danger zone, right? Now, what's the solution? Get bigger. See, if you comprise like 10% of the population, you cannot be stomped out so easily. You cannot be pushed around so easily. You are a political force to be reckoned with. And this is one reason why we need to recruit. We do. We simply do. Now, there's some good news. For the most part, people of our type, we are able to out-educate and out-populate. The types who dislike what we do. I mean, you know, who's actually having children? I mean, you go somewhere and someone says, I have 3 children. Oh, how do you do it? Drag that person to a homeschool convention. Oh, you only have 6? So, you know, we're out, and we're on the bottom of an exponential curve, honestly. I'm meeting people in their 30s who were in my writing class 15, 20 years ago, there you are. And you are having children, lots of them, and homeschooling them, and really exponentially, because the bad guys are contracepting and aborting their children out of existence. So there's good news here. But I fear the curve won't hit the political thing fast enough. We need to supplement reproduction with recruiting. We need to bring more people into our world. Okay, but face it, honestly, how many of you would say, yes, I am a better mother, I am a better father, I am a better person because we chose to homeschool, because we chose this alternative education, because we started this school, right? It makes you better individually. It makes you better as a family. Your families make your communities better. Better communities make a better country. Homeschooling is good for the nation. It's good for the world. And if you don't exercise religious freedom, you lose it. So I think we have to be willing to go out and risk maybe being a bit offensive in a true and sincere way and say to that person sitting next to us in church, so what's your problem? Why have you not pulled your kids out of school yet? How can I help you do the right thing here? You see, we got to switch it all, because here's the deal. We are the normal people. We are not average, but we are normal, because the normal thing to do is to be very involved in your children's education by keeping them home or getting together with other families or supporting a school that shares your values, your vision, your faith, something where you can raise children in that culture, that educulturation that will strengthen them for that, right? You know what's abnormal? I'll tell you what's really abnormal. Sending your child to a building you can't even walk in without permission. Being taught by people you have no idea who they are, what they think or believe. Reading books you're not even allowed to look at unless you burst in and demand your rights and be super obnoxious. I know teachers who told me that the schools actually try to prevent parents from seeing the textbooks. Right? Developing friendships and relationships with other people's children you know nothing about. Being completely at the mercy of these unknowns. What parent, what sane parent would do that? The poor people have been brainwashed, and we have regained our sanity by God's grace. So you say to that person in your office at work, you say to that person at church, you say to your neighbors, you say, come join us. Be part of what we do. The world will be better for it. And then you bring them to this conference. If every single person brought another family to this conference, poor Melissa would have to get a much bigger room. But would that be a bad thing, a bad problem? What if we could double the numbers and double them again? Not everybody would succeed. Some people can't do it. They'll go back. But there are so many people waiting just to be invited. So we raise a bigger army. Christian is a super big word, and I am not going to speak on it much, especially since I'm running out of time. But there's one little aspect of it that's quite disturbing, and I'm going to share it with you. About, oh gosh, I don't know, 18 years ago, someone gave me a book. Awful little book. Small, green, kind of a big cross on the cover. And the title was Raising Them Right by Theophan the Recluse. Now, you might wonder, what would a guy named Theophan the Recluse know about raising children? Well, evidently, this guy, Theophan, lived in the 1800s. He is revered in the Orthodox Church as a saint, and he wrote voluminously. And this was just a collection of what he had said about raising Christian children. His premises are very simple, but very disturbing. Premise one, the whole end of education is the creation of appetites. Can you go with that? That's his first premise. The whole purpose, the whole end of raising children and educating them is to create proper appetites. Premise two, the appetites of a Christian should be to follow Christ. You okay with that? Premise three, to follow Christ means living a life of service and selflessness and sacrifice and suffering, even unto the death. That's where it became awful. Because I read this and I thought, I don't do that. I don't even know how to do that. I don't even imagine how I could do this. My appetites are not that. I mean, honestly, service is great if you get paid. Selflessness, well, you know, that's kind of a byproduct of getting married and, you know, it's better than not. But sacrifice? I don't really jump out of bed in the morning and say, how can I sacrifice? In suffering, I actually try to avoid. My appetites, to be quite honest, are first-class upgrades, expensive healthy food, temperature-controlled environments, enough money in the bank to not have to worry too much. I am so awful. This book just exposed me. I didn't even know what to do. One thing I did do quite quickly was move my family from California to Oklahoma. You see, California is just too comfortable. But Oklahoma, ha-ha, there's ticks and chiggers and cottonmouths and copperheads and tornadoes and brutally hot summers and ice storms. Very exciting. I wanted my children to suffer, at least environmentally. I didn't really realize I was going to have to suffer this along with them, but nevertheless, I realized, though, and I want to just echo, and I won't elaborate at all, but our speaker this morning, I'm so sorry I forgot your name. Jason. Wasn't that awesome? Jason took an idea that I have had and just expounded it and developed it so beautifully. It's like an unfolding flower because I realized I don't have the capacity to live the life of sacrifice that would teach my children how to do it. But I do have the stories. We have the stories of the martyrs. We have the great fiction. We have everything from the simple little stories of Ping to A Tale of Two Cities. We have the great early Christians. We have the modern martyrs. And so when I realized this, I thought, I've got to really bring this literature in that does just what he was talking about, that gives us that ability to say, yes, let my sacrifice be the light that lights the world. Because I don't know. I honestly don't know. If someone put a gun to my head and said, deny Christ or die, could I do it? Could I say, no, I will never deny Christ? Do I have that courage? I hope so. I also hope I don't get tested that way. Right? But there's no guarantee we won't see a time when our children or their children will have to follow in the steps of, say, the Chinese martyrs or Polycarp, right? So the last word is communicators. And you would probably have thought, if I was talking about raising Christian communicators, I'm talking about educating children to communicate in spoken and written English, which actually is what I spend most of my time doing. And I think we do it pretty well, and some of you are familiar with how we do that. But I want to focus just slightly different, and that is, communication is much bigger than just speaking and writing. Communication is living by example. And communication of God's truth can also mean incarnating beauty. Some of your children may be given a gift, have a seed planted in their soul that will bloom, if it's allowed to be a beautiful artist. And we need more beautiful art. Or an architect who can design a beautiful church, beautiful buildings. Or perhaps a musician who can bring us to the next point of beautiful music. The world knows we are desperate for better music. I mean, 95% of all the music you ever hear in any given day is bad. It's not just bad, it's bad for you, right? But it's just everywhere. We need to change this. We don't know what gifts God gave our children, but I do know one thing. God gave your children to you, and you, by taking responsibility for their education, have the freedom to give them the opportunity to follow a passion. And when they can find it and follow it and develop it and grow there, the world will be a better place. And when they're stifled by academics or fear or this, I have to go to college and have all my ducks in line, or they get, you know, distracted by social media or video, or they're too busy and then become cynical. Because every one of us has a mission, something we're meant to do. Sometimes a very humble little thing, and sometimes the next beautiful big thing. So cultivate their opportunity to communicate, not just in spoken and written English, which I do believe is important, but also in those other ways as well. All right, so I feel a little better now. I hope you do too.